we're moving on to something that has puzzled people, annoyed people, given people hope and sustenance on one level, but I don't think anybody could do a what's a minute quiz on it yet, at the moment anyway. Apart from the, all our communications have changed in so many ways. Going online is increasingly part of our daily routine. You can check weather, read news, etc., etc. You can catch up with friends. You can talk to your friends and family all around the world. Or you can shop, or you can talk about CCTV and what effect that has on your life and how much surveillance is going on. Well, my first guest today is tasked with protecting your personal data as you go about your business, and also regulates organisations that handle your data or even data. Helen Dixon, Ireland's Data Protection Commissioner, joins me now. You're very welcome to the
morning.
Program. Just in baby English, what is GDPR? What's the purpose? And have there been unintended consequences?
So in baby language, the GDPR is the General Data Protection Regulation. It's a new EU law that has direct effect as a regulation that came into application last May. And essentially, its purpose is to regulate the processing of personal information by all sorts and all types of organisations. So it's to ensure that individuals who have a right under the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights to have their personal information protected, it's to ensure that that personal information is safeguarded and that individuals maintain a level of control over how their information is collected and used.
Yeah, but if you go on to, like, pretty well any site now at the moment, they tell you that what their policy is, and sometimes it's gallons and gallons of print that most people don't read. And if you say, no, I don't accept, they won't let you go on. So while in theory it's protecting your information, in practicality, if you don't sign this, I accept, you can't function. So you've no power, really. I mean, the consumer has no power.
So there are two main data protection laws operating in the EU. One is the GDPR that we just mentioned, and then the other is the e-privacy directive, soon to be upgraded by the EU. And it's the e-privacy directive that regulates the tracking of users on internet websites, which I think is what you're referencing there.
When they say we want to use your information and your contacts to sell to other companies.
That's right. So typically websites supply a banner to the user with information telling them how their information is going to be used and collected. And typically now what you should see is either a button that allows you accept or one that suggests you manage your settings. And if you go into manage settings, it should give you a more complete outline of the third parties with which your information will be shared. It should allow you untoggle from receiving targeted advertising, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it really depends on the scenario in which you're discussing the application.
Okay. Now, you are in a unique and powerful, and I don't know would you regard enviable or unenviable, position that you're the most important person in all of this within Europe. Explain that to us.
I don't know about that description. We've got an important job to do is the way I would put it, and significant responsibility. So under the General Data Protection Regulation, the EU has introduced what they call a one-stop shop for regulation of multinationals, which means that rather than the big internet companies and multinationals that operate across the EU being subject to jurisdiction of 28 different data protection authorities, they're subject to the jurisdiction of the authority in which they have their main establishment. And because Ireland is home to the European headquarters of a huge number of US internet companies, social media platforms, pharma companies too, the Irish Data Protection Authority is de facto the lead EU regulator for all of these entities.
If you take what happened in the American elections and indeed across the water in Brexit. And again, for some people, their minds go fuzzy when you talk about these things. But Cambridge Analytica bought this information from Facebook. This is a question, not a statement. And made a decision to use the Facebook network to target people whose profile they could guess at in order to change the direction of an election. That's really playing mind games, isn't it?
So I think this is a very serious issue that has emerged in relation to social media platforms in the last couple of years, the issue of manipulation of elections. And there are a couple of issues involved in that, not all of which directly relate to data protection. So there are issues of fake news, the spreading of fake news by bots. But there's also the issue that you referenced, that social media platforms and platforms like Facebook in particular allow the ability to target, micro-target a message directly at a user. So if you have very detailed information profiling a user, which Facebook has and data brokers have in relation to many of us, then you can target a very specific message that potentially manipulates that user or presses their buttons in terms of a message.
And how do you stop that?
So there are a number of initiatives that are now underway post the Cambridge Analytica scandal. First of all, the platforms have committed to redoubling their efforts in terms of reducing the amount of fake news that's circulating. What they have also committed to doing is tagging sponsored stories and ads which are funded by political sponsors, so that a user at least has an awareness that what they're seeing is funded by XYZ political party and that it's not neutral news. So one of the things I think the learnings for all of us in our individual lives arising out of all of this is that you shouldn't rely on social media exclusively for your news and knowledge of what's going on in the world, because where messages are being targeted at you and you can be subject to manipulation and reading essentially only one side of any story, you really need to make sure you look at a broad range of news sources to inform yourself.
I suppose it was the same when we just had print, and it is the same as we watch television, but it seemed kind of more subtle and more manipulative as it was used then. Tell me, from your office and since GDPR, what are the main complaints are you getting?
So we're getting a very significant increase in the volume of complaints and we're obliged to handle every complaint we receive from individuals in light of the fact that individuals have this fundamental right under EU law. So the types of complaints that we're getting in large part relate to access requests that individuals make to organisations.
So, explain that one to me.
So individuals have a right under the GDPR to obtain a copy of their personal information from organisations. And this is an important right in terms of being able to control and know what organisations hold and have it rectified if it's inaccurate. So we receive significant volumes of complaints every year about failure of companies or public sector bodies to respond in any way to the access request. So frontline staff in organisations are often not trained to recognise that when someone writes in a letter, they don't have to reference data protection law, they don't even have to write a letter, they can verbally make a request to say, I want a copy of all information you hold on me. Frontline staff often don't recognise this is a request for the purposes of data protection legislation and it has to be responded to within 30 days. So the first type of complaint we get is, I've been ignored by this organisation that I'm...
And typically, what range of organisations are you talking about?
So a massive range. It can relate to internet companies. It often relates in individual cases to the employer of the individual who's making the complaint from us. So somebody who feels they've been unfairly dismissed or who left an organisation in bad circumstances can often, after the fact, put in a request looking for all information held on them.
Right.
And then complains when they feel it's incomplete in terms of what was supplied to them.
Right. And if the organisation has information, which clearly it would have of, about employees, once an employee has left, do they have to get rid of it after 2 years?
So there are different retention periods applicable to different types of data. And for employers, they may have an obligation to hold on to certain data for tax purposes or based on other statutory requirements to which they're subject in relation to other forms of data where there's no statutory retention period. It's up to any organisation to define an objective retention period for which they say it's necessary to hold the data. 2 years doesn't sound unreasonable when you say it in relation to most data. It's hard to imagine why anyone would be holding data for longer than 2 years if there's no objective requirement to hold it any longer. So it really is about defining how long is it necessary to hold it for.
And who defines that?
So that's for the organisation itself. If it's not statutorily defined, for example, as I said, by reference to tax laws or audits to which an organisation may be subject, or litigation to which they're subject that's live where they will have to retain it in a specific case, then it's up to an organisation to say, well, look, the nature of our organisation is we handle complaints from individuals. Once we've closed a file and there's been no appeal, for example, in the case of my organisation, it's not necessary for us to hold that whole file any longer than a year. So it really depends.
Right. Let me go to some of our listeners. Somebody here is saying, I rang an undertaker's last week to get the address of a funeral they were handling. The deceased was reposing at home as per the death notice, and they refused to give me the info.
Okay. So if the family of the person in repose didn't wish, if the home was private for that period and they hadn't authorised the undertaker to give it out or indeed printed it in the death notice, then it doesn't sound unreasonable that the undertaker would have refused to disclose the home address.
Now, they were handling the funeral. The deceased was at home as per the death notice, and they refused to give me the info. That seems extraordinary, doesn't it?
I don't think it does seem extraordinary. So in stating that the person is reposing at home, they would assume anyone calling to the home knows the family in the home. And in circumstances where someone doesn't. I think we'd have to know the facts in this case. Where the undertaker wasn't authorised on the part of the family, it's perfectly possible the family did intend it to be private.
I mean, people go to funerals. We've all gone to funerals of people, where we actually don't know where they live because we know them through work or they're, you know, related to a colleague or related to a neighbour or something like that. You don't always know where people live.
You don't, but often in those cases you're going to the church, which is public, and you will in those cases see family home private and then when the church ceremony is. So, again, I would assume the undertaker in this case is acting on the instructions they have.
Okay. Marion, I don't think data protection watchdogs live in the real world. We can't post photos online of cars parked on cycle lanes because of GDPR. We can't have a rent register because of GDPR. Now, that business about photos, because I was going to come to CCTV as well, posting photos online of cars parked on cycle lanes is a very testy issue, and the Gardaí are given out about it, and the campaigners are cross about the Gardaí given out about it. But also, you can't have a rent register. Both of those, please. Sorry, this feels like you're doing your leaving cert. I beg your pardon.
So I'm not sure I understand the latter statement about you can't have a rent register. The general data protection regulation is principles-based, so you'll find no reference to rent registers in it. And essentially, any type of data collection or registers can be legitimised under data protection law, provided there's a legal basis, there's fairness and there's transparency. So if the government decided it wanted to implement a rent register, as it did in the case of a property price register, then it would be required to legislate for it. It would be required in legislating for it to consider all of the factors relating to privacy as well in relation to rents and to provide appropriate safeguards. So there's no definitive prohibition under the GDPR or any data protection law on the creation of a rent register. It would be a matter for government.
Okay, so you're saying you implement legislation, you don't form policy.
Precisely, we enforce the legislation as it is.
Now, cars parked in inappropriate places and putting photographs of them, obviously with the registration, maybe not, putting them up online.
So, yeah, I've been reading about this story for the last week and reading also it's been reported that the Gardaí suggested to individuals who'd posted such photos that for data protection reasons they shouldn't. I haven't spoken to the Gardaí about it, but I think what they may be referencing there is that data protection law is intended to deal with organisations processing data and typically large data sets. And under data protection legislation, in order to allow you and I administer our daily life with our family and friends, there's something called a household exemption. So that if a family member takes a photo of me and sends it round to the whole family, I can't start objecting on data protection grounds. It's assumed right. There's a household exemption for all of us to administer our personal affairs. But where private individuals step outside that household exemption, they become, in technical terms under data protection law, a data controller. And they assume then all the obligations of data protection controllers, where they're obliged to give rights of access to any data they hold. They're obliged to deal with complaints and objections from individuals and so on. They're obliged to have retention periods for the data. And I think what the Gardaí may be getting at here is that in taking an image like that and not simply using it to present it to the Gardaí to show potential evidence of wrongdoing, in publishing it broadly, these individuals may be acquiring the obligations of data controllers and may be identifying third-party individuals and, as I said, assuming those obligations. So I think, again, there's nothing specific in data protection law that's going to prohibit the publication. But individuals who are publishing in this way would need to consider, do they have a legitimate basis for doing it? Are they prepared to deal with complaints from any individuals who are identified in the photographs that they post? Are they satisfied that if the purpose of taking the CCTV image was to present evidence of wrongdoing to the Gardaí, that they're not going to harm any action the Gardaí may subsequently take if there's an allegation of unfair right. processing of data? So I think caution does have to be exercised by individuals when posting photos of this nature.
Caller wants to know, do marked electoral registers come under GDPR? This comes from somebody in Dunleary. Marked register is a copy of the register that has a mark by the name of each elector who has voted.
That's right. So, again, there's no specific reference to marked electoral registers under the GDPR, but the GDPR interacts with the Electoral Acts in Ireland as concerns uses of the marked electoral register and indeed the electoral register itself. So elected representatives do have certain specific rights under the Electoral Acts in terms of obtaining a copy of the electoral register and also the marked electoral register in the period 6 months after an election. So again, all of the standard obligations of controllers apply to elected representatives. And in fact, my office has...
Yeah, can I just ask you, is that yes or no? I mean, if it's marked to say you voted... Does that come under GDPR?
Its use comes under GDPR. So how you use it, how long an elected representative retains it, how they combine any data on it, whether they use it to create a database and then use it for all of that would come under the GDPR.
Right.
So we've issued guidance to elected representatives, which the caller might want to look at on our website, in the last month, and it sets out the rules that elected representatives must abide by.
Okay. There was another... No, I'll move on with this, because CCTV is very important as well. And CCTV, I mean, we have it in all the streets, we have it in petrol stations, we have... Like, a lot of our life is now mapped by CCTV, but it's also used by employers. And that has given rise to concern. Can you talk us through that?
Yes, CCTV is a huge topic for our office. You mentioned the issue with the cyclists earlier and the photos. We're also getting a lot of queries to our office from private individuals who are concerned that their neighbours are operating CCTV now on their homes, but that the CCTV is stretching beyond the perimeter of their homes and is recording their neighbours. And again, there's case law from the Court of Justice of the European Union interpreting EU data protection law that says that any householder that's operating CCTV where the camera is trained outside the perimeter of their home acquires the obligations of a data controller, and they must put up signage saying they're operating CCTV. They must provide a right of access to the images to anyone captured by it, and so on. So lots of issues now for private homes where they need to make sure it's trained within their own perimeters.
Okay.
In terms of employers, you're right. This is also an area of a lot of activity for our office. And each year in the annual report that I publish, we detail case studies where we've had complaints from employees that they've been subject to excessive monitoring in the workplace. And equally, we deal with complaints from employees around use of CCTV images in disciplinary processes to which they've become subject. So there was one case study that captured a lot of people's imagination in the 2017 report, I think I published, that related to a supermarket in Ireland that dismissed an employee because she placed a paper bag over the CCTV camera in the canteen at the supermarket during her lunch hour because a colleague, a friend of hers, was doing a hairstyle for her, and she didn't want this visible on CCTV. She was dismissed. We looked at that complaint. And ultimately, we found against the supermarket on the basis that it did not appear legitimate to be monitoring an employee during their period of rest in the canteen. And when we asked for a justification for why the CCTV was there, and we were told it was on grounds of security and health and safety, it really didn't seem to stack up.
Yeah, it's interesting that there would be that level of monitoring on staff. Presumably that's to see, or is it, you know, do you take a 15-minute break or do you take a 3/4 of an hour break? Would it be used for that kind of thing?
And that, in many circumstances, would be excessive monitoring of the employee by means of CCTV. There are other ways for managers to manage staff and ensure they're taking breaks that are of appropriate duration. And CCTV shouldn't be used to substitute for ordinary supervision by management in the workplace. It's excessive collection and monitoring.
Okay. Marion, your guest knows nothing about funerals in this country. People want you to come to the repose, and also reposing is more and more in the home now. Well, I'd say people would argue with you with that. I think a lot of it happens in funeral parlours, but depending on what part of the country you're in, as well as everything else, I mean, if you talk to a TD, and particularly a rural TD, well, mind you, they would know all the addresses. Why? Because of the electoral register. They would have them. Now, you met with the woman that's in Sheryl Sandberg, recently, and she's the boss of Facebook. What kind of a conversation was that?
That's right. She's the chief operating officer of Facebook. It was a long conversation. It was a challenging but a useful conversation. It's not the first time I've met Sheryl Sandberg. I actually met her out in the Bay Area at her offices last March, just pre the Cambridge Analytica scandal. So this was quite a different meeting. Aside from very specific details of issues that have arisen in the intervening period, one of the things I talked to her about is the credibility and stature that she has undoubtedly as a business leader. Her Lean In book, of course, was a bestseller, notwithstanding recent criticisms of it. But she is undoubtedly a person of some stature and credibility. And so I talked to her and tried to recruit her into the idea that she would become a much more vocal voice in supporting the GDPR and EU data protection and become a voice that carries in terms of internal leadership in Facebook around EU data protection and where it's trying to drive and the types of changes it requires of platforms like Facebook. So that was in large part what we talked about.
And, I mean, are you not caught in a kind of an awkward situation or a delicate situation, maybe? Like, the French have fined Google 50 million, isn't that correct?
That's
now?
Right.
The Google, 50 million, I suppose, is like a fiver to the rest of us when you're talking about Google. But nonetheless, it is a large sum. And the top amount that you may fine somebody is what, 20 million?
It's 20 million or 4% of global turnover of
right.
an undertaking, whichever is the greater, which could be billions, as you say, in the case of the bigger internet companies.
Right. But you're based here. They're all here.
Mm-hmm.
You have a budget of about 15 million, I understand, for you and your staff. Talk about David and Goliath. And is there a kind of a consciousness that we want these people here? So does that weaken your position when you're dealing with them?
I wouldn't accept any sort of consciousness on the part of my office. We are very clearly and constantly underline our independence from government and our independence from industry. Our cohort and our peer fraternity are our fellow data protection authorities in the EU, and that's where we associate ourselves. So we approach our job of supervising the internet companies with full independence and with objectivity in terms of fairly assessing where they're potentially infringing the law or
well,
not.
What kind of things pop up that you would be dealing with now, say for Facebook?
So since the 25th of May, where we've acquired this much harder enforcement edge and powers under the General Data Protection Regulation, we've opened actually 49 big investigations under the Irish 2018 Act and the GDPR. A whole range of those investigations relate to local authorities, actually in CCTV usage. But of the 16 inquiries that we have in relation to activity of internet companies, seven of those have been opened into Facebook. So they relate
to... What kinds of things?
So we're investigating into issues relating to the massive so-called access token breach that Facebook suffered last September, where 30 million users had data potentially exfiltrated from their accounts and their accounts accessed by a hacker. We are investigating whether Facebook is providing full access, as it's required to do, to individuals of the personal information they hold on them. We're investigating whether Facebook has complied with the obligations they have to notify our office within 72 hours of any breach that they become aware of. So we've a whole range of investigations
right.
open, as an example, into Facebook.
If you take that they all say that they're a platform, they're not publishers, that kind of crosses over on your line, doesn't it?
It does. And when you opened earlier and you were talking about fake news and manipulation of individuals, you said, I suppose it's really similar to the print media and television. And I was going to say it's not really
because
that similar. Because, of course, an argument has long been by print media and television and radio that the likes of the platforms are not media regulated in any way, and certainly
right.
not to the standard that other media are. So I think this is an issue that has been debated at EU level as to whether there should be some form of media regulation for the platforms.
That's kind of going to come, one feels.
And whether they can sustain this position that they're just neutral intermediaries in the middle of it. And that really is, in many ways, beyond the scope of the remit of my office.
Right. And there are scary things going on there. I mean, it is alleged that it has led to suicides and, you know, terrible things being presented to children. And I know that there's an Englishman taking a case to protect children, but also Jim O'Callaghan, the Irish Heart Foundation, are looking for an amendment. They want to make it unlawful to harvest children's social media data.
That's right. So when the Irish Data Protection Act 2018 was being enacted last year to give further effect to the GDPR in Ireland, opposition amendments were tabled to that act when it was a bill to try and prohibit the profiling of children for targeted yes. advertising purposes. And the government indicated, and this appears to be the case borne out by the GDPR, that there is no explicit prohibition under the GDPR on targeting of children. And so to gold plate the GDPR in national legislation simply wouldn't work. So there are serious concerns, and we hear these every day, about the profiling of children, about the manipulation of children, about the targeting of children with inappropriate advertisements on platforms, about the failure of platforms to actually recognise that they are dealing with children who aren't over 16 but may have declared a date of birth that's older than their actual
yeah.
date of birth. So because
we all did it, you know, at some stage.
So the GDPR, for the first time under EU data protection law, now calls out that children do merit specific protections under data protection law because they may be less aware of the risks and because they are more vulnerable users. But because the GDPR is principles based, it doesn't really tell us what those specific protections are. And because we consider that children really are vulnerable users and there are significant concerns around them, as an office, we've now launched a very large scale consultation into the issues around children, how they exercise their own rights. Should yeah. they be able to exercise their own rights of access, have their own ability to consent to processing? But also we want to look at these issues of how do you verify the age of a child when
right.
they declare a date of birth on the internet and verify that their parents have consented. So we're running an adult-based consultation, closing date 1st of March. The details are on our website. We're also very uniquely rolling this consultation out directly through schools and youth centres to children themselves.
Okay.
Because under the UN Convention on the Right of the Child, they have a right to be heard directly on matters that affect them.
Okay.
And ultimately, when we get the responses to that consultation, we want to produce a best practice guidance to drive forward
okay.
better protections.
Can my neighbour have CCTV of my back garden? No, basically.
No, that would be trained beyond
right.
the perimeter of,
okay.
of their own home.
Can one ask the Gardaí what info they have on a citizen?
Yes, each individual themselves is entitled to make an access request to An Garda Síochána. And in fact, I think they receive about 15,000 individual requests for access
okay.
each year as it is.
Marion, I rang a restaurant recently to send my pal a bottle of wine for her birthday, and they couldn't take my card over the phone because of GDPR. That's extraordinary.
That I don't understand. That sounds bogus as a reason for there are lots of businesses taking credit cards over the phone and GDPR doesn't prevent it.
Okay. Hi, Marion. I've been trying to get my old GP to forward my records to my new GP since 2015. Does requesting your records from your GP fall under GDPR?
Totally. That falls under your right of access to your own personal information. And so in that case, the GP should be forwarding the records
right.
and we'd be happy to handle a complaint
okay.
on behalf of that individual.
Now, I heard another complaint that a GP was referring somebody to a consultant, and the consultant was, or the GP wasn't allowed to send on the details to the consultant because of GDPR.
Again, it doesn't make much sense if an individual has attended the GP and is seeking a referral to a consultant, then it stands to reason that the GP is going to have to...
And it can be sent by email or sent it by fax.
So long as it's a secure means of transmission. We did a big investigation led by Tony Delaney at my office last year into 28 hospitals and made a lot of recommendations around handling of personal data and files, but one of them was around fax machines, transmitting documents to fax machines in areas to which potentially even the public have access or lots of different
not
people.
Not a runner. And,
yeah.
Okay. Now, what advice would you have for someone that's listening to us today and is concerned about keeping their personal data safe? And I have some of the remarks that you made down here in my notes. And two really stand out. It's to be very careful using free internet services, because it means that all sorts of information like IP addresses can be picked up. And think twice about paying for everything electronically.
Yeah, when I was talking to your researcher, I was talking about being thoughtful about how our data is being collected in everyday circumstances. And I was actually quoting some of the ideas of a cryptographer from the US called Bruce Schneier, who's written actually a book you would like, Data and Goliath, extensively on this subject. And he has some advice for all of us in terms of being thoughtful about how we're handing out our data. And he says, maybe don't pay for everything electronically with your debit card.
Companies will deal with you positively, aggressively, if you don't do it online.
Oh, I suppose he's talking day to day in shops that you visit or restaurants. Putting a plaster over the camera on any devices you have, so that if your device is remotely hacked, nobody will be able to take control of the video or camera on it. He talks about other ideas, being thoughtful about the fact that if you sign up to a supermarket loyalty program, you do need to have a look at the privacy policy. Are they sharing that data that profiles you very considerably with other third parties? Could this in turn wind up in terms of you being manipulated through online targeting, either commercially or in other circumstances?
Are you on Facebook?
I have very limited use of social media, or I'm not really a selfie type person.
Are you? You're not on Facebook. Instagram?
No.
Twitter?
No. The offices, as an office, we have a presence on them.
But you ain't putting out any information about yourself.
So for work purposes, I have familiarity with all of these. There are a variety of different reasons why I don't engage with home assistants. You know, we often talk about in terms of the digital landscape about some of these negative digital externalities
that language for you. What is an externality?
It's an idea like where we use our devices more and more and we're addicted and it's clear that platforms use means of rewarding us to keep us addicted to them. We're also using up more energy, depleting batteries, creating issues for the climate. So there are lots of reasons why I would limit I do in certain contexts, and not all data protection or privacy related. I think for individuals, there aren't necessarily right or wrong choices.
Yeah.
It's about being thoughtful and deciding where your line is.
Okay. Do you enjoy your job?
I do. It's a very demanding job.
I can believe it.
It's a lot of responsibility. It's a lot of travel because it's a very international job. It's a lot of media engagement internationally and nationally. But I do enjoy it. I work with some very inspiring and very committed people, and I believe in what we're doing.
Okay. We will leave it there. That is Helen Dix. Oh, just before you go, because there was a story on Liveline about the woman who the hairdresser wouldn't give the colour of the dye that they used when colouring her hair. just wouldn't do it because of data protection. Now, very briefly.
Yes, that's right. Joe Duffy featured that story. Yeah. Wrong on the part of the hairdressers.
Okay. Because some bizarre decisions are being made here. Anyway, Helen Dixon, as I say, Data Protection Commissioner, thank you very much indeed for talking to us. And we take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.